I'm James Mossman.
And I'm Magali Rodriguez Mossman, and this is Conscious Clowning, the Clown in Liberation Transformation Work.
Okay, should we start with the...
Let's start. We're going to start with a slide
to turn lights off.
Presentation. And I don't know, you know, those windows. It's pretty light. Do you think you're going to see it from there? Can you see? This is in the way? Very interesting. Maybe we're going to have to move like this.
Sure, there is. Yes, there is a screen over here.
There's a screen over there. Would that be better?
We've already set up there. That's fine. We can work around this.
Sure, we'll just
Please, as you look at this, try to get into the kind of people that you're looking at, especially in the first part. You know what's...
Remove every
Might be interesting to hear from you what you picked up.
That people like that could accept a clown coming into the human theater. Whereas a person like he just went in, they would probably stand.
And that's true, that was our experience.
What was the last purpose?
If we just walked in as we are, they would stand off from us.
Well, it's the universal denominator that allows us, to, as a clown, to move in any situation and be accepted positively. Because all people want.
Everybody loves clowns.
They see this as clowns rather than as our own forces.
Your turn. It's louder.
The clown provided sort of one side of happiness or laughter in the situation, which was pretty dismal.
Provided laughter in the situation, which was pretty dismal.
That a clown can say things that people normally aren't allowed to say.
Right on.
And without words.
Clown doesn't need language. That's the beauty of a lot of these people that we were dealing with were Spanish-speaking or Creole or French-speaking. And there was no need for language with the clown. And the communication was there. Anybody else?
Nobody was afraid of the clown. right?
It's a very equalizing situation.
Right. You saw the man where James was in this corner and he was over there. He was doing something and you couldn't see, but he was helping James pump up a balloon because he's such a klutz that he can't get a balloon blown up. So he has to, somebody pumps his arm, you see. And the farm worker has to help him to do it. So the role reversal.
Reverses the roles.
We found it. Yeah.
Before the clowns, I found it interesting that your slide showed that there not only was a lot of hardship in their life, but a lot of joy to go along with it.
Well, they were certainly survival oriented folks down there.
It depended on the camp, too.
What was the specific situation when you talk about camp and down there at the time?
Okay, we should probably say that. Should I start with the history?
Why don't you start with the history and then we'll talk about it.
Real briefly,
into this.
In 1970, I returned to the United States and began to work, actually in 72, in one of the migrant camps, the most affluent of the migrant camps first. And then, little by little, got into doing more and more work with more of the isolated ones. For whatever reason, because of the work I had done in Santo Domingo, which is another long story that you don't want to get into, I had become very interested in the most isolated, the adult, illiterate, older person, you know, whoever that was. And we had gone about discovering that there were a lot of small slave labor camps in South Florida. They're all over the United States, but in Florida they're very, very predominant. In those areas where there isn't a lot of, they aren't metropolitan and the legal assistance is not available, particularly now with the new administration where all the legal assistance has been pulled. The situation is really worsened tremendously. But anyway, we had found these small illegal camps. A couple of them were legal, and we say slave camps because the people were literally bought and sold, you know, in some cases. And in other cases, it was more like an indentured type slavery where, and I say this exists today, 1983, I just came back from Florida and the situation has gotten worse instead of better, where people would owe the crew chief so much money that they couldn't leave. And they would be just passed on from one to another. And in some cases, they were Mexicans. But in many cases, they were North American black people or Puerto Ricans who are American citizens, speak English. Many of them, though, come from the hills of Puerto Rico and don't speak English. And then, of course, the more isolated they are, the more they are not part of the mainstream, the easier it is to do this sort of thing to people. Many of the people that we were meeting didn't know their own names. They had nicknames, they didn't know who their parents were, they didn't know how old they were, didn't know where they were born. They had no papers of any sort. You know, they were totally undocumented. You know, when they were born, they were not, how do you say, inscrito?
There was no
birth certificate, nothing like that. And so people that I worked with became notary publics. In order to give them a name and some sort of identity, they would give them a birth date that they would remember, like the 4th of July or the 25th of December or the 1st of the year or something like that. They'd give them a birthday that they could remember, and then they'd give them an official name, and they would sign it as a notary public. Now, this is totally illegal. I'm telling you this because it's after the fact, and everybody's gone, and we'll never know who did it and when it was done. But these, in order to document that people were actually alive, you know, that they had some existence in the society. Well, I founded a small center called the Liberacion Learning Center, or the Liberation Learning Center. And it was had a bilingual name because we were dealing with people who were often bilingual, you know, different cultures. We were very interested in Hispanic people and black people and, you know, anything that was there. And in this sort of a situation, we were interested. And in order to, we had learned some things. We did liberating education. If any of you are familiar with Paulo Freire's work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, liberation stuff, where liberation theology came, you know, arose out of that sort of work out of Brazil and some of that. Well, I took that stuff and adapted it to the Florida farm worker situation. And we had had a you know, after a few years, you know, what you might call success, you know, everything we had done, because we would only choose those things that the farm workers were willing to do themselves, you know, that everything we did was successful. Because there were just myriad numbers of problems, or just incredible numbers of problems. And if we allowed it, they would simply dump all those problems on us and expect us to solve them. And of course, we would fail, because we didn't know all the intricacies of the problem. But we had the selector system. Number one, we wouldn't do anything for anyone. That was number one. Number two, if they weren't willing to work on it, we weren't willing to work on it either. Even though we, our paternalistic selves, you know, were hooked over and over, you know, we did learn that just simply didn't work. And number three, another thing that we would never give charity of any sort. We'd allow the Red Cross to do that, the churches could do that, but the center itself, people involved in the center would never be involved with charity, because once that sort of a relationship got set up, we knew we were lost. Another rule that we had was we would not work on symptoms. We would work on causes, you know, so that we wouldn't be doing Band-Aids, but rather we'd try to go to the root of things. And of course, it got us into all sorts of trouble. The Klan got all upset. Took 3 years to get them off our back. And stuff like this. But by the time 1977 rolled around, 1978, which is when I first met James and got into to thinking, I had been asked to be a prober. I was not a Lutheran at the time. 1976 was the year. I was asked to be a discovery prober for DSMA, the National Office Discovering Ministries. And this is a group of interdisciplinary people from different, you know, one was a physicist and James was in human sexuality, somebody else was in black concerns, women's concerns, somebody else was doing stuff on peace, Floyd Schaefer was doing the clown, faith and fantasy, John Schramm was doing, simple living and so on. Just a whole series of about 15 or 20 people doing something like that. And I was invited to come in and met James for the first time and Floyd Schaefer, and they were talking about, we had, by the way, in the Liberation Center, we had gotten to the point by 1976-77 that we knew that as a group, farm workers were never going to be free because of the multinational corporations that own most of Florida. They control Florida. And we knew that with this sort of power, with this sort of, you know, with small groups of people thinking new thoughts and things, we knew it was just over. In a linear sense, it was all over. So we had developed all these enormous charts about how farm workers got into poverty and how they stayed there. And we were depressed, as you can imagine. We were just, you know, under the carpet. It was so bad. So I land up at the national office. We just had a strike, and many of the people that we'd been working with over the years had organized a strike, and the strike was successful, that part of it. It was soon reversed, you know, and that was the sort of thing that we were seeing happen over and over again, that there was just too much power on the other side, there was too much control, there was too much money, and the Klan was on that side, and the FBI, and everybody else, the police, you know. For example, if these farm workers ran away from their crew chiefs, the police would take them back to the crew chiefs, because often, they would be the parole officers. The crew chiefs were the parole officers. So even if they beat them, you saw a picture of a man there, a white man with a big nose. Well, he had been beaten many times, but also his tongue had been cut out. You know, one time way back. You know, because he talked too much and he was too sassy. And that's the sort of thing I won't tell you all those horrible stories, but it's a horrible situation.
Real interesting system, really. The multinational bringing them in because of the inexpensive labor, the enforcement of the Klan and the police, and because of the coalition, even between the government, it was easier to sometimes look the other direction. So you had all of the weight of the whole system kind of against this group of people and those that would be helped.
Okay, so I come up to the national office, have this meeting with these probers, and begin talking to these people. I was overhearing conversations about the clown using another part of the brain, you know, that was different, that when things in the linear sense like didn't work, there was this other part of the brain that kicked in, and then there were like new possibilities. If you kind of stood in a different place, you could see something from a different perspective, and I started getting very interested. Didn't say one word the first time around, you know, the first year, but when I thought about it for a whole year, came back the second year, and I saw him for the first time, I said, you know, I've been thinking. I wonder what would happen if we got clowns and farm workers together. And it, no logic at all, absolutely no logic. I just knew that there was something here that we ought to take a look at. And so I was always into doing crazy things anyway. So that's what happened.
Yeah, the other side of the coin was that I had been involved with a member, or have, I guess most of my professional life, with a member of different kinds of things. I'm never sure how they got into that. But, for example, using laymen to teach pastors in CPE. Nobody was doing that back in the early 60s. And
clinical pastoral education.
Clinical pastoral education, some of those kinds of things. It's quite common now. But one of the things that I'd gotten involved with was a little holistic health center community that we established called the Croft, that was existed for the renewal of people who are into ministry, health care, or education, because we're running into the fact that nobody was caring for the care, and I think that's still pretty true. There's no place for personal renewal. The second was that a lot of times the most creative ideas were going down the drain by the time you had met the safety needs of most institutions. And I'm not saying institutions shouldn't have safety needs, but I think it does take some experimenting and playing around with different kinds of ideas before they can become usable. And there was no place where that could happen. And the third was that a lot of the best learning that I had experienced was from talking with people kind of in a tutorial or in the kind of visiting scholar model that's used quite commonly in Europe. And so that was our goals of doing the Croft. At the same time, I was in discovering Probe Ministries and doing the sexuality program and so on. And one night I'd met Floyd Schaefer, who I'm sure some of you know, and we ended up staying up all night talking, because I was very much intrigued with how, in dealing with sexuality in the broad sense of the word, you're really dealing with identity questions. What does it mean to be a man or a woman, and the particular man or woman any of us are? And that was a certain kind of energy. I wasn't using, or wasn't even aware of, some of the kind of Eastern terms that are used for that, Kundalini, and some of those were very foreign to me, but I was aware that we were dealing with a kind of energy. And in talking with Floyd that night, became real aware that metaphors such as the clown and the history of the clown as the oldest art form were also dealing with a part of identity. It's part of that community. I'm convinced there's at least one and more clowns in every one of us. That these wrinkle lines aren't wrinkles at all. They're merely clown lines that go down here. And if you study your face long enough, you know who your clown is. And so I'd invited Floyd to come to the Croft to do a workshop, a training workshop. And he and I, we made the agreement, and he came about 6 months later. Well, in between that conversation and his coming, I'd gotten into a rather heavy depression myself over some things going on in my own life, and was really struggling with it, and went to this three-day seminar simply because somebody needed to kind of coordinate it, and I'd said I'd be there. And so I went and went through the motions of trying to learn from Floyd what you did to get into clown and so on, and tried very hard to be what I thought I was, which is generally an optimistic person. And I couldn't make it work. Nothing would fall together. I kept hearing Floyd say, you know, with the clown, everything is possible and so on. And all I was doing is tripping over my own feet, and everything was falling apart. And so finally somebody suggested, why don't you try a sad-faced clown? So I decided, okay, what's to lose? So I tried it, and then everything started to fall together. That part of me that I'd been denying, that part that was seeing the world in a real pessimistic way, started to have some expression. And I could exaggerate it, and I could play with it, and people were starting to help me, like they do. Sad, nobody likes to see a sad-faced clown, so you always try and cheer them up. And you can stay sad-faced, and you succeed by staying sad when they're all trying to cheer you up. And, you know, you really get into self-pity in an acceptable way and have fun with it. And that started to really kind of come alive, and the end result of it was it broke through the depression for me. I could begin to detach enough to look at what was going on and say, no, I can make a choice. I don't really want that. Well, then I was also working with a couple. This is a long background, but it does hook up, I promise you. I was working with a couple that I'd had in counseling for, 6 months, I suspect. And I had tried everything that I'd learned in 20 years of counseling to work with them. They had one of those symbiotic relationships, you know, where they can't get it together, they can't live together, nor can they separate. When they were together, they would literally almost kill each other, and yet they couldn't bring themselves to separate. And so in desperation one day, I said, let's try something, we'll call it counseling. And I told them, I said, what we'll do is, and I gave them some background on the clown, the history of the art form, and I said, we'll go into whiteface and see what happens. Since it's a mask of silence, it's a death mask, you're permitted to die to whatever you want to die to for a while, and try out some different things. And they agreed, and we set aside 6 hours to do this. Well, 16 hours later, and I promised myself I'd never do that again, they had broken through some things. I broke all the rules of clowns. For example, the primary rule is no one can tell anybody else what their face ought to look like. So instead of doing that, I said, why don't you put on his face to the woman? And she took the grease pencil and attacked him with it. But found as she really looked at him and who his clown was, she couldn't stay with that and started to erase it. And then really struggled through all of the emotions and tears and finally got a face on as she saw him. It wasn't a very pretty face, but she got that on. Well, he kind of learned that you don't do that with a grease pencil, but he got into so much anxiety at one point, he literally couldn't hang on to it. And finally got through that, and then we went out. I had nothing better to do, so I went into clown, and we played together nonverbally with some stuff. And then we went out of it and talked about it, and then they had to struggle to put out how they saw themselves. And the thing that happened was they were able to resolve this relationship. They did separate, but they were able to do it in a respectful and caring, loving kind of way rather than an attacking way. And that impressed me. So that was kind of the point I was at when I went off to this Probers meeting and heard Magali talking about all of these people that were struggling with unsolvable issues in their lives, but on a much broader sense. And I'll never forget my first... I kind of sat there in awe and listened to her talk about all of this stuff, you know, and play the guitar, and I thought, gee, that's really neat, and so on. And finally, after about the second day, I got up my courage to go up to her because I'd done some work with massage, and I was just reaching over to start giving her a shoulder rub, and she got up and walked away. I never saw her again for another year. But then we got together. Do you want to finish? Okay, I'll
start that part then.
But that was where I was coming from, was more from the constant point of view. But still real aware that something powerful was in the art.
Personal liberation, group liberation, you know, and we're getting this thing together, trying to figure out what would happen. We actually got a grant from the federal government, if you can believe this, to do clowning and massage with farm workers as an initial involvement technique for education. Now, can you believe it?
The tragedy is, I can.
We just hoped we didn't get the Golden Fleece Award.
Yeah. Actually, it worked. It worked better than anything else they had tried. It worked very well. What we found was, and we did explain what we were trying to do. We explained that the clown was a mechanism for involvement, you know, that it would capture people's imaginations and their interest. It's very hard to get farm workers' interest. As you can see from there, they tend to be very depressed, you know, and they tend to be dealing with survival issues all the time, multiple problems. Get their attention, to get them to come to a meeting is impossible, just impossible. But if we use the clown, and if we use music, if we use drama, poetry, any of those kinds of things, and then massage was absolutely the clincher. We had taken James in several times, and we realized that he did very well when he came in as a clown. So the next time we'd bring him in just as he was. He would still get a good reception, and that's unusual for a white man. And those of you that were in the multi-channels workshop back on Monday, we were dealing with the white male being the symbol of the oppressor. He's the symbol of the farmer, of the corporate head, of all of those people, the policemen, all those people who oppress the farm worker, who hurt them, who take things away from them, who make their lives miserable. So taking a white man into a migrant camp, or even into just a regular farm worker area, is not pleasant. You know, it's things shut down. People just don't relate. So we brought him in the second time, and we found that people were still relating. And then tiny, because James is a very tall man in comparison to these men from Mexico, undocumented workers. One day I introduced him, they had seen him as a clown, and then I introduced him as a person who knew body work, who knew how to do massage. Well, they started lining up.
Yeah, we had a line. Length
completely unexpected. Hispanic men are not supposed to want to be touched by another man. Well, I don't know where all that stuff went, right out the window. As we found out, that is not true. Well, it is true, but it isn't true. For this particular case, that all that stuff just disappeared. They began to line up, and this one had an elbow, and this one had an ankle, you know, this one had a shoulder, and this one had a leg, and, you know, they're the walking wounded. We found that through the body, that was another big, big key to a relationship. So we said, aha. And so we put this thing together in a grant, and we got it and did it. And it was just a wonderful. And today we've got all the groups in Florida have come to an agreement about how to proceed in terms of farm workers in this very critical time for them. This is a very bad time for farm workers these days, these years. They've decided that what they want to do is they want to put together mini liberation centers. And what they mean by that is not like the center that's in South Florida. Right now it's still there. It's not a place, by the way. It's a group of people with an idea. And they want mini centers, which means that they will use community building techniques, the arts, you know, that the center developed, massage and clowning, to do building community among farm workers so that they might get together with people who are not farm workers, you know, people from cities and so on, to better the lot, to build these relationships. Now this is 5 or 6 years later. It takes a long time for this sort of thing to happen. But the whole state, all of the farm worker programs decided they wanted to do that. That's really unusual and very gratifying. And it started with that silly experiment. But what we found was that
one thing that really I chuckled over, and it interested me, but I think it also shows something about the way in which perceptions can change. That when they would bring me in as the clown, and usually that'd be preceded by music. The street musicians would so-called juice them by playing, and they'd get moving and so on. And then I could come in as the clown, and it would become sometimes almost like swarming. Children and then adults would want their faces made up because they somehow sensed, well, every culture has its white-faced clowns, for one thing, and they somehow sensed that they could die to whatever was going on at the moment for a while and try out some other kind of behavior. And because my clown is a real confused, mixed-up Scotsman, as some of you might have seen the other night, and he has trouble doing anything, and so he's literally the clod and needs all the help he can get, they would start to help me, and they would call him the El Payasito, which is the little clown. And then when I'd come in out of whiteface, I was still El Payasito. And here are these people, you know. and I was still the little clown, but it changed their perception. I was no longer, what's the word I'm looking for? The white male,
the oppressor.
The oppressor, or but the gringo.
The gringo, yeah.
That would be the oppressor. And that interested me a great deal, and that also I chuckled over, and I felt real complimented by it.
Yeah, It was quite we didn't know anything at this time, by the way, about the brain. We certainly didn't know as much as now. We didn't realize that we were reaching the limbic system, which is the community building brain. We didn't realize that through the use of a nonverbal form, that was the perfect way to get in, you know, to get through all that stuff. We began to imagine these places as the migrant camps that we were going into as places that were in a state of deep depression, and they were. And you go in there and you could just feel it. Many of them, and you could see the pictures of some of them, you know, they would sit there like this. And they'd be drunk, or they'd be on some sort of drugs and so on. And to get them just to look at you was a major issue. And we would go in sometimes 5 and 6 and 7 times, and still they wouldn't look at you. And it was very, very difficult. But bring in music, bring in the clown, and all of a sudden you've got people playing. We did not know at the time that when people begin to play, when they feel joyful, when they're happy, when they laugh, and all that it releases endorphins in the brain, it causes the depression to lift, and all of a sudden you're using more brain cells, and you can solve problems better. You're more open to learning. We didn't know all that stuff. But the way we visioned it was that we were injecting positive energy into a place that didn't have a whole lot. And if there was nothing more we could do, we'd already gotten to the place where we realized that there was nothing we could do to liberate anybody. Nobody can liberate anybody else anyway. We knew that. And there was nothing we could do to break the bondage situation that they had. The only thing we could do that would in any way make them feel better about themselves and better about us was to inject some sort of joy into life. So we, without realizing it, we were just going to be there with them and try to enjoy one another. Well, lots of things happened. Places started getting cleaned up. And many of the men got out of the places where they were. One camp, which was the very worst one, had a movie filmed there about slave labor in the camp. They paid the men $35 a day. They gave them three meals a day. They all fattened up, you know, tremendously. They were all very, very skinny. They were just so proud. They showed us the building that they had burned for the movie, you know, and they showed us, and different people, they would do their lines for us and everything. You may have seen it on television. It was a television movie called Angel City. I don't know if anybody saw that. Angel City?
Yeah.
And it's also a book. Yeah. Well, the camp that we were working in was the camp that book was written about. You know, it's a horrible place.
Far South was the name of the camp, and it really was. It was way on the edge of the Everglades, and you could drive by it. If you didn't know specifically what grove of trees to look at, you would not see it. And that's the way those camps were hidden. You could.
What kind of crop were they working with down there?
Down in South Florida, they have, it's vegetables mostly, tomatoes. It depends on the group. The blacks like to do things like cucumbers and corn and that sort of thing. And the Mexicans like to do tomatoes. But there's lots of different kinds of vegetables.
You mentioned the multinationals before. Can you be more specific? Is it Del Monte or a number of them, or who is it?
Coca-Cola. Minute Maid, Arvida Corporation, Duda, nice Lutheran.
Green Giant. Whatever that's. Become.
They go by different names, you know. They're parts of bigger corporations, you know. Pardon?
General Mills.
I'm not sure. I haven't run across that one. But. Some of them, you know, don't even realize that they're into food. You know, they have any Tropicana, you know, up in the citrus area, and so on. You know, they're just too big. It's much too big. Okay, just some stories. Okay, in Florida, and one of the things that happened just as we were leaving in 1981, there was a big pesticide conference put on by the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, the EPA, there are lobbies in Washington, you know, and the EPA spends a lot of time listening to the owners, I mean, the corporations that put together pesticides, you know, to the DuPonts and to the chemical companies, Shell, and most of the oil companies have also chemical. They make pesticides. But they decided to put on these pesticide conferences for farm workers to hear what the farm workers had to say, because they don't hear the voice of the farm worker. So they were going to do that in Orange County, in Apopka, in Florida. Now, Florida has an Orange County that's very similar to the California Orange County. It's a very, very rich in terms of soil. It's owned a lot by the people that have the land there tend to be rather wealthy. And so on. And they were going to have this conference, and it was specifically to take testimony from farm workers about how pesticides affected them. just before the conference, there was a big notice that went out to the from the Farm Bureau to bring the farmers in. Now these, so the farmers came in. Many of them brought guns. Many of them were the owners of the land or the leasers of the land where these farm workers worked. Once they saw the farmers there, many of them just simply left because they knew they would lose their jobs. They could not testify in front of these, and they were all white men, okay? A couple of them, the heads of the Farm Bureau in Florida came in suits, okay? And these farm workers were coming in just like that, you know, with those kinds of clothes. And they were very frightened to begin with. They would not have used their names, but they would have taken the testimony. They wanted to take the testimony in person. Some of them, they offered to let them speak like behind a screen or things like that. But the fact that they were even there at the conference was very dangerous for them.
Almost all of them showed up with their families. And there was a reason for that, I discovered. And that reason was that if they'd left their families at home, they were running the danger of them being kidnapped, or some of them.
You know, which, I mean, these sound like stories from outer space, don't they? They happen, and it happened a lot. And not every farmer obviously does that sort of thing. I mean, obviously, you know, but we were dealing with a group of about 50 or 60.
Don't blame the farmers. What we're talking about here is the reptilian brain.
Okay.
These farmers had their livelihood and many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars tied in their operation. And they saw any kind of rebellion on the part of the farm worker, which was their labor source, as a real threat to their very survival and the survival of their families, and they would come out and say this openly. So what was being hooked by conferences like that was their reptilian brain, I'm going to fight in order to survive. So it wasn't that they were bad people necessarily. They were no better or no worse than the rest of us, but they were threatened.
So we get in and we got 50 or 60 white farmers, many of whom had guns, very angry with this small number. But by this time there were, 22 or 23 farm workers, many of whom were children. And they were supposed to be the ones who were speaking. Well, the first day, as one poor little farm worker got up and tried to speak, there was a doctor that had come with the farmers who was so angry that he was yelling obscenities, saying, you know, that it wasn't true, that they had not been poisoned. You know, the farm workers were just simply saying, you know, that our whole family gets rashes. Many of the pesticides are related to the nerve gases, okay? And they cause permanent liver damage. They cause a lot of headaches and a lot of rashes in the body, many, many side effects. Many of the farm worker children, if you go through the camps and you go through those homes, almost every family has a retarded child of some sort. You know, learning disabilities and all sorts of, in Florida, during the time that I was there, that was up until 1981, the federal government would not allow the University of Miami, we're gonna have to stop, to test for the effects of pesticides on human beings. They could do it for animals and they could do it for plants and things like that, but not for human beings. Mm. What happened was, we thought there was gonna be a fight. Someone was gonna really get hurt. So we brought the clown in. You know what happened? The next day, they started talking to each other. They had farm workers and farmers in the same group, and the farmers were saying, you know, we ought to put out some booklets, maybe in a cartoon form, you know, so people who don't read English, maybe they could understand, you know, how to take care of themselves, and they won't get hurt from these pesticides. Complete change. We were stunned.
The doctor of entomology that had been cussing at them, I went up to and started playing with a love balloon. And he couldn't resist it. He started to play, and he even got his picture taken and so on. And he mellowed, and he actually came around with an apology.
He apologized to the whole group.
To the whole group. It was, you know, I sat there in tears.
So, on that wonderful note, thank you.